19 hours 30 UTC on Monday, January 8th, and this is Zimbabwe Today.
The new government of President Emmerson Mnangagwa hopes that shedding some of the dozens of money-losing state-owned companies will give the budget a boost.
That was Kudzai Zunawashe in Harare reporting on the Parliament's discussion on the new budget. We'll have that story and more coming up.
Good evening, I'm Chidonjere.
And I'm Kintanai Mutetwa on VOA Zimbabwe Today.
Most Zimbabwe members of parliament spent Monday at the seminar deliberating on the 2018 budget that the government presented late last year. Economists and other experts joined them to chart out the future of the budget. Reporter Kudzai Zunawashe has the report.
Jacob Mudenda is Speaker of the National Assembly. He says Parliament has to make sure the budget meets the needs of people.
You can preach a better sermon with your life than with your lips. Thus, Parliament as the supreme representative body of the land must lead by example through passing a pro-poor people-centered budget.
Mudenda adds that Parliament has a mandate to hold government accountable, to seek transparency and work for policy consistency and predictability. He says many find the 2018 budget a break from the past.
Since the presentation of the 2018 budget, I've read and heard several comments from the business sector, civil society, and some individuals. They all extol the 2018 budget as reformative, prudent, inclusive, well-balanced, transformative, and refreshingly novel in its thrust.
Thabani Moyo is the spokesperson of Crisis in Zimbabwe Coalition. He is less upbeat about the budget.
The challenge of that budget is it has not moved much from the Robert Mugabe era budget. It is within the almost 5 billion shield. It means that we are still in the recurrent expenditure mode, and that most of the revenue that we are getting will be going towards salaries.
Government expenditure has been the country's major headache as it endures economic decline. The new government of President Emmerson Mnangagwa hopes that shedding some of the dozens of money-losing state-owned companies will give the budget a boost. Parliament was granted $57.2 million to operate, just over half its request of $100 million. Members say the shortfall means it will be impossible to carry out its constitutional duties. Apart from this, members agree the Ministry of Health needs more money.
Apart from reviewing the budget allocation for Parliament, the Minister of Finance and Economic Development must consider revising upwards the budget for the Ministry of Health and Child Care. Without life, you can't do anything.
Parliament is expected to vote on the budget within the next several weeks, but some political sources say it is likely to need several changes before it's passed. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zunawashe from Harare.
The Zimbabwe Anti-Corruption Commission says it is investigating the wife of former President Robert Mugabe over the doctorate degree she was awarded in 2014. The commission says members of the sociology department at the University of Zimbabwe asked for the investigation, alleging it was obtained fraudulently. At the time Grace Mugabe was awarded her PhD in sociology, many of her critics said she had studied at the university only a few months. Doctoral degrees often typically take years to earn. Last November, the military seized control of the government and President Robert Mugabe resigned after 37 years in power. While he remains revered as a leader of the liberation struggle, his wife, Grace, has been a divisive figure.
Social media has a lot to say about the news that the former First Lady, Grace Mugabe, is under investigation over her doctoral degree. It is seen variously as justice, a waste of Anti-Corruption Commission resources, and an indictment of Zimbabwe's education system.
Noam Pofu says, she has a fake doctorate, that's it. She's going around being called a doctor, yet giving foolish suggestions.
Atana says, this only opens eyes to many who did not know the level of corruption which Mugabe perpetrated in the country.
Taurai Kundiso says, why don't they leave her? Who will employ her in this world, even if it was a real degree?
Nyasha Mazivisa says, it's a waste of time. Many of us have such useless papers in our wardrobe, and they don't seem to be on demand, and revoking such a paper from her is like the UK revoking its knighthood from Mugabe. It's not an event.
Paul Chuma says, this will or has tarnished the educational system of the country. No one will ever trust our academic qualifications, just as I don't trust most. I'm sorry of our people's academic excellence. The Pharmaceutical Society of Zimbabwe has raised the alarm over a looming shortage of critical medications within the country. Zimbabwe imports most of its pharmaceuticals. However, imports have stalled because of the lack of foreign currency and unpaid debts. The Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe late last year promised to make pharmaceuticals a priority. However, the bank has not been able to meet its pledge of making available $4 million a week to keep medicines available. I spoke with Portifa Mwendera, Vice President of the Pharmaceutical Association of Zimbabwe, about the problem.
Okay, presently we do have a challenge in sourcing forex for importation of medicines, mm-hmm. and also even for raw materials for production of medicines. The situation has been getting worse every day since around July 2017, where the allocations from banks to the importers, to pharmaceutical importers, have been going down all the time. So now what's happening is we are now failing to meet demand for regular medications for some conditions. Like presently, we do have a shortage of insulin. We do have a shortage of BT medications, some BT medications, and also even salbutamol for asthma.
I know that there was a certain amount of money. I think it was $4 million allocated, $4 million a week that was allocated for pharmaceuticals. Has that level of funding been met?
Okay, so the governor, the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe, made that statement to say that they were allocating $4 million per week to the pharmaceutical industry. A position which, as the pharmaceutical industry, we asked for substantiation from them to actually indicate which players they have been awarding that $4 million. Because our assessment shows that our manufacturing sector needs $1.8 million per month for importations, and then also our wholesalers, the list that we gave to the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe in October this year, showed that we needed about $15 million. So at $4 million a week, they would have cleared that in just a month or two. But so far, nothing is happening. Of the amount that we actually gave them, invoices that are outstanding, they have not done much in terms of payments for that. The $4 million figure is for the industry is, we're actually asking the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe to actually show proof or to maybe even indicate which players have been getting that so that we can make follow-ups, because presently we are not seeing that.
What would be the consequences of running out of the drugs that you need?
This will be dire, because we're talking of critical medication. So right now, yes, we may try to run around and maybe alter therapies to try and use what is available. But the issue is, as long as what we don't have funding to restock, it means there's going to be one day when somebody needs insulin and no one has it. So it's a very critical condition. It's a very critical situation which may arise if we actually completely run out. Right now, some wholesalers and pharmacies have gone on to start rationing supply, so that we remove a culture of hoarding in the institutions, just to make sure that everyone who needs is getting something. But we are slowly getting to a point whereby you get a prescription and you can't fill it. You look for options, your options are limited. So in the end, care is compromised. And this is medication, we're talking of life. So life in its sense is compromised.
That was Pordiva Mwendera, the Pharmaceutical Association of Zimbabwe, speaking with me from Harare.
With the political changes in Zimbabwe, many conversations have focused on the topic of how the new government will differ from President Robert Mugabe. On human rights, one big question is how well President Emmerson Mnangagwa will tolerate government critics and protesters. Two recent cases have drawn attention. The first is the arrest of an American, Martha O'Donovan, who had faced up to 20 years in prison for allegedly insulting 93-year-old Mugabe. The second was the New Year's Eve arrest in Bulawayo of 8 youths who were demonstrating against Mnangagwa's involvement in the Gukurahundi massacre 30 years ago. Their lawyers say the young men were beaten by the army and police. The 8 were charged with insulting the person of the president. That is the same charge that Mugabe used against critics when he was in power. I spoke about these cases with Nyaradzai Gumbonjanda, the African Union Goodwill Ambassador and human rights lawyer in Harare. She says while it is not clear what they signify, it's critical for the country to have a government that is open to criticism.
There are a couple of things that are very critical for me, that looking at where the country is at the moment and where the aspirations are, it's very important that citizens have the possibility of expressing themselves to any government. So the right to protest is important to enshrine and to protect. And we know that we still have laws which limit that right. POSA, IPA, all these laws still exist. So we hope that the government would repeal these laws. So on a matter of principle, the freedom to express oneself is important. Secondly, it is important that there is due process. If there is an infringement of a law, then there has to be due process. And people have to be properly charged if there is a breaking of the law. I did not follow the details around it. I just know that the charges were dropped. But it is important that there is due process where there is an infringement of the law. So it's important to establish whether there was an infringement of the law. And if there was, then due process has to be used. But also, as I said at the beginning, it's also to make sure that as a country we don't continue to have unjust laws. Lastly, the content of why the protest. I think it's very important that as a country, as a nation, we continue to address some of the fundamental issues that remain unresolved. I think the issue of Bukurahundi remains unresolved. It's important for the country, the government, the National Reconciliation and Healing Ministry, and the commission, it's a Chapter 12 commission, be able to take necessary steps so that we don't remain on the same spot as a country, as a people, over generations, over decades, over centuries. People have hurt each other.
As a lawyer yourself, what's your take on the American journalist, Martha O'Donovan, who was arrested and now released?
What was clear to me was whether the information that was on public record was the true information on the basis of which she was charged. I would have wanted to see a little bit more of the evidence and the rationale and the justification for the action that was taken. I think it's very important for us to understand the role of the Ministry of ICT and cybersecurity, to understand what is the meaning of the cybersecurity, what is the range and breadth of the cybersecurity. I think some of these cases just raise a number of issues around freedom to critique. I think we need to have the same freedom to raise issues, to critique. And as I said, I was not into the details of the case, but I followed the case with a measure of interest, and I was just quite intrigued.
That was human rights lawyer Nyara Dzaigumbojanda speaking with me from Harare.
There have been diverse reactions in Cameroon after the arrest in Nigeria of 9 separatist leaders who declared the independence of the English-speaking regions of the Central African state and gave it the name Ambazonia. Some English speakers oppose the arrest, while other Cameroonians are celebrating what might be an end to a year-long crisis. Moki Edwin Kinseka reports from Boue, southwestern Cameroon.
Hundreds of children at the bilingual high school in Moliko have defied calls to stay at home and have returned to school for the start of the second term of Cameroon's school year. Among them is 16-year-old Glory Mbui, who says her father forced her to come to school in spite of threats from the armed separatists.
I'm afraid because they're having supporters that might continue the disorder in the country. I'm equally afraid because that I'm armed with Chinese soldiers that might equally continue the killing of people in the country.
The call for all children to stay at home was reiterated by the separatists after Ayuk Tabe Julius, the man they called the president of the independent state of Ambazonia, was arrested alongside 8 members of his interim government in Abuja, Nigeria, on Friday. Businessman Evaristus Njie says he supports the separatists because English-speaking Cameroonians are marginalized. He says Nigeria and Cameroon should free the arrested leaders.
The government has been claiming that they are dialoguing with them. How can they claim that they are dialoguing with them for the peace to return? Why at the same time they arrest them? It's not good. Free the Ambazonian leaders and dialogue with them for peace to return in the country.
The unrest in Cameroon began in November when English-speaking teachers and lawyers in the northwest and southwest regions, frustrated with having to work in French, took to the streets calling for reforms and greater autonomy. In October, secessionist groups declared the independence of Ambazonia and armed conflicts erupted, prompting a crackdown by the military. The UN has said the violence pushed at least 7,500 English-speaking Cameroonians to flee to Nigeria. Last month, Cameroon's defense minister, Joseph Beti Asomu, visited deserted towns in the border regions and called on the population that fled to return.
The inhabitants of some of those villages have closed the border to go to Nigeria, and I want them to come back to their villages and retake their activities, their normal activities, since security has already been re-established in all these villages.
Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Boya, Cameroon.
Sierra Leone marked a grim time in history over the weekend. It was on January 6, 1999, that the civil war officially arrived on the doorstep of Freetown, Sierra Leone's capital. Rebels invaded the city and began to torture, rape, amputate limbs, and massacre the city's residents. Sierra Leone's civil war originally broke out in 1991, but until 1999 had only been taking place in rural areas of the country. The rebels wanted to overthrow the All People's Congress government at the time. After weeks of fighting in Freetown, the rebels were driven out by the members of the Economic Community of West African States Monitoring Group. Nina DeVries has more on how people are feeling on this anniversary.
For Zainab Kamara, the memories are still fresh in her mind.
It was devastating. It was horrible. The sounds of machine guns. It was like hell to be. But this was like hell.
Several days after the invasion as fighting ensued, she was standing just outside the back door of her home when she was hit by a sniper's bullet, leaving her paralyzed from the waist down. She was only 14 years old at the time and has had to use an electric wheelchair since. To this day, she doesn't know who shot her or why. She kept the bullet that was removed by a doctor.
I actually wanted to see the thing that caused me this kind of pain, this kind of terror. So they gave me the bullet and I have it with me. So I just look at it and I hold it, you know, closely to myself. And since then, I did not pass the bullet because there are times when I find things difficult, when I say things, you know, when things become so tough, I'll just look at that bullet and I'll tell myself that if I survive this bullet, then I could survive any other thing.
The country's civil war, officially declared over in 2002, left at least 50,000 people dead and thousands more displaced. And as this anniversary unfolds, others in Sierra Leone are taking time to reflect on what happened. Frank Coker remembers going out trying to find food after being in his home for several days after the invasion.
When I came out from my house, I saw, you know, people carrying dead bodies around, taking them from one point to another. You see, maybe they will just kill someone and say you are able, because everybody was panicked. There was no trust.
Sierra Leone's Ministry of Social Welfare and Gender and Children Affairs acknowledges that the January 6th date is significant and people should not forget what happened. Department Minister Aizata Kabia says the ministry is planning psychosocial counseling specifically for those affected by the war. She says that many believe people who endured the violence are okay and have moved on from the civil war, but that's not the case. People are still traumatized, and the ministry is working to put in place a program for group therapy sessions. It will start as early as next week, she says.
We have to help souls heal, because without individual souls healing, the nation will still be a little bit fragile, and it's our responsibility. And this, I think, was a missed opportunity right after the war, but it's never too late.
As for Kamara, she says despite what happened to her, she will keep moving forward. She has already started an organization that advocates for those with disabilities who she says can often face discrimination.
There are times I also think about, what about those that died? Where they, thank God I'm alive. I'm here to see this day, to commemorate this day.
A thought perhaps many will have on this January 6th anniversary. Nina DeVries, VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
New York is a magnet for immigrants. One of them is Nigerian-American writer Obioma Nwokolo. VOA's Adam Phillips brings a report on her series of children's books about a 10-year-old African princess who loves to make friends, solve mysteries, and protect wildlife.
Obioma Nwokolo's path to success as a children's author was anything but straightforward. She came to New York in 1989 to study fashion design, then decided to become a pharmacist. But when her son, now 10 years old, was bullied on a school bus, she penned a series called Power Kids to help children spot and cope with bullies. Before long, Nwokolo was getting up at 5 every morning to write, and the Princess Amelie series was born.
Princess Amelie is a 10-year-old African princess. Amelie is a short form of Amalicha, which means beautiful.
The first title in her series, Princess Amelie, The Coronation and the Polka Dot Lamb, is a mystery story where Amelie must overcome a family curse.
She's a smart, intuitive, exciting, and funky, and always looking to do something different. And she really, really wants to have friends. And so in the first book, it's introducing her funkiness and how eventually the curse is broken and she solves the mystery with her grandmother.
Nwokolo writes her books for all children, but girls from 6 to 12 years old are her primary audience. Nwokolo says that when girls identify with powerful female characters like Princess Amelie, it inspires in them a sense of self-esteem and possibility. After 28 years in America, Nwokolo still misses her childhood home in eastern Nigeria. She says the atmosphere she creates in the Princess Amelie stories recalls the life she once knew.
I grew up doing all the things Princess Amelie does in the book, like the food, pounded yam, fish soup, okra soup. I mention all those, the way it tastes, the way it's prepared. also talk about the climate, how warm it is, where you wake up in the morning, go to the river, you see the fruits fall from the trees and you eat them there. It's so beautiful, and the people are warmer, friendly.
Mwokolo's books do touch on some serious subjects, like poaching. In her recent title, Princess Amelie, The Cheetah and the Chatterbox Parrot, Princess Amelie and her friend go to a group of villagers to explain why they should take a stand against poaching. She warns them that fewer animals will mean fewer tourists, and therefore bad economic times. And then there is the cruelty of poachers, who often take the ivory tusks from living elephants and leave them to die in agony.
People hack the elephant tusks out of their heads. And she says to them, imagine if your tooth was pulled out without any anesthesia, or that aliens came from another planet and strung your eyeballs as Christmas decorations without asking your permission. This is what we're doing to the elephant. And when they say that, kids are like, wow, that's true. So it creates awareness. It's hopefully get kids to act and pay more attention to the environment, enlightening your community, and you're doing something to help your society.
So far, Princess Amelie books are mostly sold in the United States, but Mwokolo is in touch with African educators. She wants these books to be part of school children's reading lists. She has also begun to market a Princess Amelie doll. In America, most dolls are white. Mwokolo wants African-American girls to have a doll that looks like them. That way, when they read about the princess's amazing adventures, they can say, I could be this girl myself. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
That is it for us this evening on VOA Zimbabwe Today. I'm Kuntanai Mutetwa.
And I'm Chidondere. We'll be back again tomorrow at 9:30 p.m. Zimbabwe time for the latest news and analysis in English. VOA Shona and Debele broadcast can be heard at 7 a.m., 2 p.m., and 7 p.m. Zimbabwe time.
Stay with us around the clock on Facebook at Studio 7, VOA Debele, and VOA Shona, as well as our VOA website, www.studio7news.com.
Next week, we'll be staring.